Yeah, I think we'll start on quizzes with quizzes on Wednesday. And so we'll kind of do that as a routine. And then after we get into enough material where we can, you know, maybe start producing some philosophy about ethics, then we'll kind of switch out, and instead of a quiz one day, we'll do like a paragraph assignment. And then you'll turn that in, maybe beyond that, outside of class. So we kind of work our way up, but we'll kind of keep the quizzes around. And I don't know if I was a little inconsistent the first week of classes. I'm not sure if I mentioned this to you guys, but I'd like you to think about the quizzes as the kind of commitment we're making to each other to come to class ready. You know, you guys have a lot of things pulling your attention, a lot of small assignments in other classes. You know, a week is a pretty busy week for you guys. And so in the shuffle, you know, if there's sometimes if there's no external thing that kind of reminds you that you have an obligation to do this, to be ready for each other, then it's easy to let that slip and say, oh, I'll catch up on the reading later. I'll probably get a lot out of class anyway, and I hope you do. I hope in the days that you don't get to your reading or it doesn't go very well, you still get a lot out of class. But I guess I want you to think of the quiz as not just an assessment of how you're doing and getting stuff out of the reading that we need, but a kind of commitment to each other, like you would if we were playing a team sport, like you'd commit to showing up ready. You know what I mean? Can I get a little nonverbal on that? Okay, you don't have to agree. You say, you could show puzzlement, I'm not sure. But I think it's a reasonable request, and I think that the proof is in the quality of our discussions if we come, you know, game ready, right? The quality of the discussions is better, the quality of the philosophy is better, that's what we're here to do. We're here to become better philosophers, especially about ethics. So I hope that's a reasonable commitment. So I'm going to hand out. So there's the other thing. Did I mention about the pseudonyms? It's on the handout that you have about the website, right? So we have this crazy practice of pseudonyms. So I'm going to give you your saint names today, and then in the future, after a quiz, you'll get an email back showing everybody's performance by saint name, and so you can kind of see where you are in the pack. Getting 3 out of 4 right on a quiz sounds pretty bad when you think about that's a 75%, but we do curve the quizzes. And so how you're doing relative to each other is kind of more important. So if you see that list of grades and you're in the top half or the top quarter, that's better information for you than just finding out that you got 3 out of 4 right. You see why? Okay, good. All right, so we're always open to questions, but let me go ahead and hand these guys out. Abby? Sakura? No? Wrong class? Rosen? Michael Rosen? No? Wrong class. Let me try this one. I don't know how I can be so confused. I do know how. Sam Olson?
Yeah.
Hey, here we go. This is looking a lot better. Okay, so keep your saint name secret now. If you don't like your saint name, you can come and change it. You can ask me to change it. Emily? Let's see. Flipped around. That's weird. Sabrina? No? Yeah, see, I probably got these all mixed up. Tito? Hey. Matthew Zucca? No. Laura Mark? Wow, I thought I did a decent job. Faye Matt. Amy Wall? Great. John Strand? Look up your saint if you want. Allison Tamer. I got these 5%. Madeline Hummel? No? Ah, good. Okay.
Sure.
Elizabeth Cito? I'm sorry. Cito. Right. Jeff Keppel? Kelsey Smith? Sarah Blazer? Aaron Mitchell? Oh. I must not have done a good job sorting. Jordan Batras? Madeline McReynolds? Darius Mianchi?
Yeah.
Sunya?
No, she's not.
She's not in this class. Jason Wines.
Here.
Jessica Kleber.
Here.
Kelsey Jackson. Jesus Lopez. Michael Fan. Lauren Olson. All right, we got one of the Olsons. Macklin. Okay. And Rudy.
Right here.
Great. Did I miss a few?
I missed a bunch.
Okay.
We'll figure that out.
Okay, maybe we'll do that after class. Let me go ahead and show you, we didn't really need to run that, but then I forget all the time. I always forget to restart it. Okay, so what we want to do today is we want to understand the main research, the results of Ariely's article. We want to do, and this is really our first effort at doing philosophy, we're going to do this a little bit together and then in small groups. We want to try to figure out what, if anything, this kind of research tells us about the nature of ethics. Okay? So let's start our notes there. You know, make sure that today you leave having an answer to both of these questions, all five of these questions. But so if put it in your notes this way, if Ariely is right, what must be true about ethics? That's a pattern question that philosophers ask a lot. I'm going to repeat it for you. If Ariely is right, what, if anything, follows must be true about ethics? Just take a minute and think about that kind of question, because that's a question we're going to use a lot. It's a way of asking what are the implications of something? What are the implications of new knowledge? What follows from a piece of knowledge? And then on the Singer reading, we've got kind of three concerns. So that's something philosophers do a lot. Over millennia, philosophers have been people who we're consistently interested in asking the question, wow, if we know this now, presumably it's new knowledge, right? We didn't know this before. Wow, the Earth is not in the center of the universe? Oh boy, right? That's a big one, right? Cheating varies by these factors? That's a little one, right? There's a little piece of research. What follows, right? So as you can imagine, you know, when we figured out that the Earth wasn't in the center of the universe, that upset a lot of things. But and figuring out that cheating varies in these ways that this research brings up, that is also very important, you know, smaller scale, but that's also a very important kind of result in ethics in the last 30 years. And I mentioned it at the first day, it's the influence of moral psychology on ethics, and in this case, environmental and social psychology. Okay. For Singer, what we want to know is, Singer's obviously, did you notice it's a totally different kind of literature? Did you notice that the writing was so different, right? One's a Wall Street Journal article reporting a psychologist's research, right? The other is an academic philosopher, Peter Singer, famous ethicist, going to read a lot of this writing. Writing in kind of a theoretical argumentative mode, is that a fair way to characterize it? Can I get a little nonverbal on this? I want you guys in the game, okay? Okay? Any reactions to that? So he wants to know, what's the relationship between ethics and religion? Is ethics objective? Are moral values objective? Big topic. What's distinctive about ethical conversations? What is ethics talk? How do you know you're in an ethical conversation, a conversation about ethics? And a good part of his argument really has to do with paying attention to how we talk when we talk about values. I don't think you should have done that. What is that like? Is that like, I disapprove of you doing that? Is that all that means, right? Or does it mean something else? If it's just, I disapprove, that's like, I like chocolate ice cream, right? So when we're thinking, so we'll get into this, I don't want to get ahead of myself with these questions, but, did I leave my markers in the other classroom? Holy cow, that's bad news. Okay, I'm going to go get them. But I know the guy who's in that class, he'll think it's funny. But so just to get us going, I'm going to ask you to look at the Ariely article in a second. But on one of the things I try to work into some of our classes, especially early in the term, is to kind of highlight philosophical methods. Like, what does it mean to be doing philosophy as opposed to just talking about something that we all read? You see what I mean? I want you to start to get an idea of that over the next few weeks. Because you have a lot of classes where you read stuff and you come and you talk about it, and they're all different disciplines. What's distinctive about, how do you know when you're doing philosophy? Well, these are when you're using philosophical methods to achieve goals of philosophy, you're doing philosophy. And leaving the goals aside for the moment, although you have a kind of link to a longer article there, or a longer page there about philosophical methods, today we're going to be theorizing from new or established knowledge. We're going to be identifying presuppositions. We're going to be talking about defining terms. We're going to be talking about fitting principles to cases. Maybe we'll get to all of this, maybe not. And counterexamples. Okay? So in the Ariely, what I'd like you to do is take a couple of minutes now. Maybe you haven't seen this reading for a few minutes. If you have it available either electronically or in print, did we agree that that was kind of a goal? Come to class with either an electronic or print access to this reading. Just take a few minutes and just browse, page through it while I go get the markers that I left behind, and I'll be right back. Couldn't do it. He was like really, like he was in the middle of explaining something really complicated, and I thought, oh God, I can't interrupt. So, if nobody has a non-erasable marker, then we'll just kind of do it without. Okay. So, did you have a chance to browse through it again and remind yourself? Okay. So, one of the things we're going to get a lot of this kind of research in this course. So, if we could just take a minute right now and talk about how to report study findings, and then we'll get into the article. So this is an experimental study. You can have observational studies where you're drawing data from watching something happen. You can have survey studies where you're giving people questionnaires, right? I'm sure some of you know this a lot. I hope it's not too redundant. But you can also have experimental studies, and what distinguishes that is that you have different conditions. You have an experimental condition. So you usually have a control group, and then one or more conditions that are being tested, right? So what are the conditions in the Ariely? Like, what are the different,
We have the condition where they shred the...
Right, and then you have another condition, somebody else? Good, thanks for getting us going.
Varying payment amounts.
Varying payment amounts.
Having another cheater in the room.
Right.
Using tokens, so it's distantly.
Distancing the money, the arrival of the money. Yes. Yeah, that was cool.
They barely proctor too.
They did it one time with a blind proctor. What's the deal with the fashion thing? I missed that detail the first few times.
Wasn't it like it was called the what the hell method or something like that? It's like if they're already wearing like fake Gucci sunglasses and they're more likely to like.
Yeah. So what the hell? I'm already faking all the stuff I'm wearing, you know, which is a weird thing, but plausible. You know, it's not a speculation about what's going on in the person's head. So the different conditions are the things that we want to measure the difference between. And then what was the immediate result? So that's the proximate result. The proximate result is that we found that under some conditions people cheated more, under some conditions they didn't cheat more, and in some conditions they cheated less. Right? Am I correct? A little more number. Okay, go a little faster. This is the important step. There's the proximate condition of the experiment, but then this is where the philosopher always wants to come in. What's the significance of this experiment? Like, what can you what implications, what follows? If, and remember the question I asked you to write in your notes. If this is true, what might be true about ethics, right? So let's do it. I mean, let's take a look at Ariely. So you guys remembered all the conditions, right? Did you have any questions about some of the results or any of them? So as you're looking at those different conditions, so what I would say is Ariely's research on the matrix task involved putting test subjects, it was an experimental study, involved putting test subjects into different situations where they might or might not cheat and trying to figure out which conditions affected cheating. The immediate result of the test was that we found out that in the shredder condition, people were probably cheating. In the payment condition, the amount of payment, people didn't cheat more. In the probability of getting caught didn't affect cheating. In the distance of payment did increase cheating. Presence of a cheater in the room did increase cheating, right? So reciting the Ten Commandments did decrease cheating. Okay, so those are the immediate results. All right, wow, this is great. Now we're at the doorstep of doing a little philosophy. How exciting. Okay. Before we get to that, kind of, if this is true, what must be true about ethics, could we get some reaction from you guys about, what did you think of this?
Not surprising.
No surprises throughout the whole thing, or in general, you're not surprised by what? Try to say what it is you're not surprised.
I wasn't surprised about all his experiments and how that increased or decreased shooting.
Okay. Other actions?
I thought it was interesting how all the little cheats added up to be a more terrible total than like few people that cheated a lot.
He frames the article in terms of that. Like, you remember the story, the anecdote about the locks? Right, you know, it's framed in terms of that there's really not that many people that are big cheaters, but that most of us, under the right circumstances, will fudge. What do you think about that? That may not be a surprising result, but it should challenge some other belief you have. A lot of times philosophers are like, well, okay, maybe you're not surprised by this, but what belief might that challenge? What's a kind of normal way we have of thinking about who the cheaters are? Yeah.
There's like honest people and dishonest people.
Yeah.
Some are cheaters, some are not.
Yeah, it's about character. What is this research suggesting? Is it suggesting that, God, I gotta be able to write something, this is horrible. Is it suggesting that the character is meaningless in ethics? Nonverbal, can I guess nonverbal? No.
Or at least that said character can be manipulated.
Right. Character doesn't, can put this in your notes, character doesn't tell the whole story, right? We aren't honest just because of our training, though that doesn't mean that it's not a big factor, right? I'm going to have to interrupt him. I don't know if I can do this. I'll be right back. I feel like it's
be
like...
Be brave!
Like, I know... I decided to interrupt a philosophy colleague because it's kind of fun to watch philosophers get interrupted and confused. Okay. Now, where were we? Yeah, I'm confused.
Character doesn't tell the whole story?
Yeah, character doesn't tell the whole story. Okay. What's coming into the picture then if it's not character? How would you describe what's influencing people's cheating?
Self-interest.
If it was self-interest, yeah, that's a good start. If it was self-interest, you'd think that people would cheat more if they could get more money.
Well, it's self-interest versus a sense of feeling good about yourself. You know, obviously,
right.
We tout honesty as being, you know, the great virtue, but clearly being fully honest oftentimes backlashes.
Right.
And so the whole, like, little white lie thing that we teach everybody about, and gray lies, and all these, we've got all these terms for them anymore. So it's a balancing act.
Just let's just try to drill down on what it is we're balancing. I think that's good stuff.
I was just thinking about the integrity thing, like how they offered a little bit more money. People cheated the exact same, but when it was like $10, people cheated less because
right.
they felt like that was a little bit too bad.
Yeah, right, right.
So it's kind of balancing, like this is a little bit of a lie, but that's too much.
Yeah.
That's good. So there are limits. There's limits to how much somebody will cheat. And maybe, so yeah, good, that's good. There's another hand up here.
I was in the same boat.
Okay. Okay, good. Other reaction? I'm still looking for people to articulate what it is. You said it's a balancing act. I'm still listening for what we're balancing.
I think it's kind of balancing what other people think of you. So
right.
when they could shred it, they couldn't know what they did. When there was someone else that was cheating, they think it's okay because the other person thinks it's okay to cheat. If the person's blind, they can't know. So as long as they think that like their self like image isn't going to be damaged, like the other person's image of them, they will cheat.
Self-image matter is at stake. Reputation. Self-image is about reputation. Yeah, good. That's really, that moves us forward. Yeah. Self-image in, so the, I like the balancing metaphor that we had, you know, that you've got these things that you're balancing. One of the things you might be balancing this against self-interest. So that you kind of moved us, started us in that direction. But we're also balancing self versus social, right? Let's call it social standing. How other people see you. Add that to your notes on, you know, I don't have to write everything on the board, right? Do you have a question?
Well,
have a comment?
I was gonna add to it.
Good, please.
I know I don't remember where I heard anything with NPR about like a study similar to this, that they
sure.
would have like a tip jar, and when they had like a picture of like a flower sitting in front of it, tips stayed the same, but when they put a picture of like someone's face, there was way more tips.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel like it's like
yeah.
more
yeah.
like the image that you have of yourself and how you think people will see you,
right.
but not actually like how people see you.
Being aware that you're being seen can be triggered by a picture of eyes. There's another related set of studies where people found in, you know, in an office environment where there's a communal kitchen, one of the problems is it's hard to keep it clean. It goes to the lowest kind of common slob. And so if you put a picture of somebody's eyes watching the microwave, they clean up. Isn't that weird? That's kind of weird. So now we're getting more data into the picture. That was very helpful. Thank you. But now we're getting a little more. We're getting a little more of a clue about what's going on. I guess a word that comes to mind here is, you know, there's a whole field. We have some psych folks in the room, right? A whole field of environmental psychology. Anybody know what environmental psychology studies? Effects of the environment on our psychology, something like that. that's good enough for what we need right now. So the other here is from character. You know, we were trying to, well, what else is it? And we got there just right. We worked through some of the things that are going on, some of the balancing, but really kind of the domain we're in today is that it turns out that ethics is somehow conditioned by our environmental psychology. Well, what is our environmental psychology? There's a whole field. What are we going to do with this? Let me add a little more detail. One of the things environmental psychologists like to find out is how the environment might change our cheating. But beyond that, what psychological mechanisms are at work in determining the cheating rate? The psychological mechanisms. Where did we get the mechanism that led to cheat a little, don't cheat too much? Where did that come from? Right? And the answers to that are gonna, lately, in the last couple of decades, the answers to that, put in your notes, come from evolutionary psychology, which overlaps with environmental psychology, because it's a fair bet for a lot of researchers that one of the reasons where we have these predictable and repeatable psychological reactions to environments is because they evolved in us, right? We have one of the biggest growths in knowledge in the last 30 years has been the discovery, it's been uneven, the discovery of the deep psychology of our evolved nature. And this is what evolutionary psychologists study. So what if that psychology, which we've picked up over a long period of growth in nature, through nature, change in growth through nature, what if that psychology is still with us? You know, what if our brains are designed so that we don't kind of start over as modern people? We kind of build on the old brain, right? You're going to read an article about that soon. Okay. So now I want to keep pushing this now in small group. I want you to take it into the small groups and really address that question I gave you. If this is true, what, if anything, does it tell us about ethics? Okay? And I want you to kind of make each keep a list based on the discussion in small groups. I want you to see if you can tease out some claims. They don't have to be compatible with each other. There's more than one implication from this research for ethics. But remember, if this research is true, what follows for ethics? For getting into your groups, you know, a good piece of advice seems to be to introduce each other to each other, you know, make sure you know who you're talking to. You don't have to get into a big, long discussion about your life story. You'll have time for that, a little bit of time. We'll probably just kind of ask you to spontaneously form groups of 4 to 5 based on, like, you know, back 2 rows, front 2 rows, these back 2 rows, front 2 rows. You guys can figure out how you want to break. You know, you back 4 or 5 people and you front 4 or 5 people. Well, we're going to have to figure out how to mm-hmm. keep them. Okay, yeah. Okay, well, could you guys do that? And move your chairs. Turn your chairs so that you're looking at people. And if you're the odd person out, go get up and go to another part of the room and visit some people over there. What might be true about ethics? Did I say what follows? And you notice philosophers are really into different degrees of necessity. So what's necessarily going to follow, what might follow, what could be true, et cetera. Yeah. So what did you guys get in your small groups? Let's see what came out. Try to throw out some of the results. Yeah, please.
We said that it's really situational, right? Because in the article talks about how people believe that people are either honest or they're dishonest or cheaters or they're not. But when you look at the results of the study, it shows that when you change the circumstances, when you change the situation that they're put in, that's when you see people acting differently, and I guess you see their true colors.
Right. So ethics might be more situational than we thought. Yeah. Others? Good. That's a good start. There's lots of implications from this.
Maybe that, like, not everyone lives up to their ethical standards because, like, someone might believe that, like, cheating or lying is wrong, but then when they're put in a circumstance where it could, like, benefit them, then they could, like, go back on that.
I'm gonna spin it a little bit, if that's okay. Hey, there's more to say here. I mean, we fail to live up to our own standards. That's a good point. But it's worse than that. You know, we fail when we could be honest. With little effort, we could be honest. We fail under conditions when there's not much pressure to be honest, but there's opportunity to cheat a little. That's a weird result. That's a weird implication, because you would think, I think the normal pattern would be to say that, maybe that does make sense. Maybe we fail, you wouldn't think it would take a trivial provocation to cheat. You see what I mean? You'd think that all things being equal, yeah, maybe we'll cheat sometimes, but you wouldn't do it just at the drop of a hat. And so that's a little surprising. Other results or comment on this one? We need to get some more on the board. What else came out of your groups? Yeah, we failed to live up to our standards. Good. How about starting a sentence with, maybe ethics is more like this? And we did that a little bit. Ethics is more situational. But could we get a little bit... Let's try to get a few more. Maybe ethics is really part of how humans do what? See what I mean?
Don't kill each other.
Well, what work? Take a minute, think about it.
Organization within the society, possibly.
Yeah. there might be a social function to ethics. Ethics might have something to do with how we manage our place in, vis-a-vis others. Yeah.
Ethics might be more of a goal than a reality.
Yeah, it might be an ideal. If we're all willing to cheat a little bit under trivial provocation, then that's a good consequence, right? Good. They're not ethical ideals. Don't really describe our experience. They're abstracted from our experience. Yeah. Others.
It's very cultural, so it's like people are raised differently in different environments, so mm-hmm. they have different, slightly different ways of viewing life and how other people should be treated.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that goes hand in hand with situational. But
absolutely. Good. Yeah. Good. Say that one more time.
It's cultural. I don't know. Everyone, you know, your culture is based on your environment. Everyone lives in a different environment. So, you know, everyone has different way of growing up and viewing ethics and, like, I don't know, like.
I like the idea of saying it's cultural because that kind of connects to our last result a little bit, because I'm thinking about the Ten Commandments part, because the fact that people respond to the Ten Commandments to recite, you know, they cheat less when you recite the Ten Commandments, that's a cultural artifact, right? Responding to the Ten Commandments, right? So we're capable of being pulled by ethical ideals, but they are still abstracted from our experience. Okay, let me suggest one. Any others? You got some more? Yeah, please.
Could that have been like the way that you were raised too? Because like I was like watching an episode of, I think it was Criminal Minds, and this little girl was like, oh, she like went up to this lady, oh, I lost my mom. While the mom, like the real mom, like went into the car and like stole money. And like, so it's like the mom was like teaching the little girl like it's okay to steal. So
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like how you are raised.
Could be. I don't know if this particular research result would tell us that, but it would make us more likely to believe that, okay, let's think about environmental psychology. It would make it more likely that the environment that you get trained in would have an effect on your honesty. So I don't think this follows directly from this research, but I think you're on the right track because you're making a connection between environmental psychology and upbringing, which happens in an environment, right? Yeah, good. Others? I just don't always have space to write everything on the board. No? Okay. I'm going to push a little further on this. So these are what I would call these first two especially would be, I would consider these to be proximate implications because they don't involve going super far from the research results. Philosophers want to tease out implications that are both proximate and distant. So a couple of more distant implications would be maybe ethics is part of a social system for making group humans successful in groups. I'm going to rephrase it a little differently. Does this make sense? Maybe ethics is part of a social system. Group dynamics for success. In other words, it's one of the ways, maybe there's better ways of saying this. I'm always trying to say things more succinctly. Maybe ethics is part of a group evolution strategy. Oh my God, that's kind of a nice way to put it. Let's write that down. Maybe ethics is part of an evolved group strategy. maybe groups can tolerate a certain amount of cheating. That's another potential implication. Maybe human groups can tolerate a certain amount of cheating. There's a point at which the environmental factors might tip it so that everybody cheats. Oh, this is a bogus system. You know, it's not on a system. I don't have any confidence. I'm going to cheat. So that would be a second one. The key thing here, and we can move on. We can stay on this, but I think we should move on to Singer. The key thing here is to pick up this intuition that maybe ethics isn't just about being a good person. Maybe ethics is something that we've figured out how to do to keep groups following values that lead to success. Can I get a little nonverbal on that? Does that at least sound plausible as a potential? Maybe the Ariely research is showing us this deep psychology that has to do with maintaining ourselves in a group, right?
So maybe ethics is a verb instead of a noun.
Yeah, it could be a part of a process. It could involve social processes, so they're active, yeah, good. Does that work for anybody? Do you hear it? Maybe we'll get one more for it. One further. Let's see. This is going further than you would have inferred from this research, but it might help to get a little more content on the thought. Maybe ethics is a system in which we figure out whether to cooperate or defect. Let's put that on the table. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it, but I'll explain it. Maybe ethics is part of a system where we decide whether to cooperate or defect. Right? Cheating is defecting. Following the rules is cooperating. That implication foregrounds the individual a little bit more. It's like maybe, you know, in an ethical environment, I always have a decision to make whether to look like a good person and advertise my reputation, be trustworthy, or maintain that image while satisfying my self-interest, right? Maybe doing it secretly. Did any of you read about the Ring of Gyges in Plato's Republic? Did that come up in a class? No, maybe not. Anyway, no need. All right, let's stop there. Any questions about this exercise? So this was an exercise in which we practiced a couple of philosophical methods, I think mostly theorizing from new knowledge, and we got a chance to practice how we would draw implications from research, how we would describe research results. Okay.
I actually have a question.
Sure,
about you're saying that we cheat for or whatnot for the group.
Not that we would cheating would be defecting, cooperating would be solidarity with the group.
Yeah, what's with the group? I feel like people do it for themselves, not necessarily for other people.
I like that. See, did you hear what she's saying? Why do you need to bring the group in? Isn't ethics just a way of maximizing your self-interest, period? The only reason I'd push for my formulation is because you could take that road. You could make that claim, but then you'd still have to explain how sometimes maximizing my self-interest involves cooperating with a group. See what I mean? So getting the group comes back into the picture, because so much of what we do seems to have to do with maintaining our standing with others. You know, acting normal, acting interesting, acting like somebody who would want to talk to you, who would be talked to.
That's for your self-interest, because you want to be part of society.
It's okay, yeah, that's what I like what you're doing. You could say, well, why can't you, see what she's doing here? It's philosophy, right? Why can't we just boil it all down to self-interest? Yeah, you can, but then your philosophical account has to still incorporate the notion that sometimes my self-interest is promoted by cooperating with a group. So yeah, it is ultimately, you can have a theory where it's ultimately about self-interest, but you're going to wind up accommodating this evidence, right? And this evidence seems to suggest that one of the ways we think about our self-interest is by reputation maintenance, right? And that's a commitment to the group. So cooperation and defecting is still a decision. Would my self-interest be furthered by cheating? Would my self-interest be furthered by making sure everybody knows I'm a really honest person? Okay. Good. Okay. Other questions? Otherwise, we'll move on to Singer. Could we just change gears? Could you get the Singer reading out that you did? This was too much, and it was too theoretical. I'm sorry. I think it might have been a little bit much for you. But I want to get some results from it, and we've got a lot that we need to talk about and read. So let's just kind of go through this a little bit. I'm going to do this direct instruction because we've got some notes here that will help get us through the article really quick, and then we'll kind of raise a couple critical questions. So yeah, feel free to be paging through the article or swiping through it as you go. And I didn't pick up on everything in the article, but you know, his one of his major claims. So what the notes you should take on this is really just to identify his major claims, right? So he makes major claims about a number of meta-ethical questions. The first one being, ready for your notes, what's the relationship between ethics and religion? And here he takes the position that most philosophers have today, though we need to nuance it. It's not, which is that ethics and religion have to be separate. And the reason they have to be separate is because God wanting something isn't what makes it good. God wants the good because it's good, not because he wants it. God wants the good because it's good, not because he wants it. Another way of saying the same thing is... it just dropped out. Yeah.
This is inherent?
It's not good because God wants it. God wants it because it's good. And that's the lesson from the Euthyphro, pre-Christian Platonic dialogue, right? And in the Euthyphro, that's the question that comes up. Is what's pious, pious? Is what pious meaning the right thing to do? In this case, there's a kind of state religion involved. Is what's pious, pious because the gods love it? Or do the gods love it because it's pious? Are you hearing that? Don't say yes if you don't. That's the difference between radical, put it in your notes this way, that's the difference between radical subjectivism, it's good because the gods love it, and radical objectivism, or at least a domain of objectivism, you can still distinguish positions there, which is that the gods love it because it's good. The objective goodness of the value is there first. It's not made by the gods loving it. Got to run that around your head a couple times. So that's a standard argument. Now, does that mean that religion has nothing to do with ethics? Can we get a little critical work on this real quick and then move on? Can anybody articulate how religion? I agree with somebody nodded yes. Yeah, it doesn't mean that religion has nothing to do with ethics. It's just make sure this is clear in your notes. It just means religion isn't a truth maker in ethics. It's not, something isn't morally good because it's advocated by a religion. If a religion advocates something as morally good, it's because it's good, and they recognize that it's good, right? Another thing to add to it, so that's one way that religion is still in the picture, right? Another way that religion is still in the picture is that being good is about being called to ideals. It's about having your empathy for people. It's not about this. It is affected by empathy, sympathy, a heightened feeling of concern for others. The Ten Commandments thing works because it calls us to an ideal. So religion plays a vital role, potentially, could play a vital role in motivating us to be good. Once you're sensitive to environment, then going to church every Sunday kind of sounds like a program for kind of keeping yourself kind of motivated by these ideals. There's other ways to do it, but that's at least one way that religion might be involved. So I don't want you to take away a hostile message about the relationship between ethics and religion here. a lot of religionists would agree with Singer here. He is an atheist, but a lot of religionists would agree with Singer here. They would say, the reason, the values we teach in church are not right because we teach them. They're right. We've discovered these are good values for people to have. So going to church isn't about, you know, making it right. It's about kind of like reminding yourself, kind of reminding, you know, getting the feelings associated with those values stimulated. Somebody had a question I didn't catch. Someone put a hand. No? Okay. Good? You sure? Okay. Is that clear? Can I get along for? Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, so ethics and relativism, big topic. What we've got to, I want to just work through a couple of points here. The first is that there's something like superficial relativism, which is simply that our moral values do vary. They change over time, they change by place. And the most naive form of relativism is to just look at that fact, that set of facts. Moral values change. Get that in your notes. And then add the details. Time, place, history, et cetera. And the most naive form of relativism is to look at that and say, well, there can't be any, there's no objectivity to values. Look at how it changes. And Singer starts with a pretty standard philosophical routine here on relativism. Singer says, no, that doesn't follow at all. It is true that things change. The same act under different conditions can have a different value, but that doesn't mean that that moral values, that there isn't an objective moral value underlying that, right? So casual sex and birth control is an example. The principle that you shouldn't have kids that you're not ready for might be an objective value that underlies the moral value against casual sex. So the traditional moral value against it. Now that you can prevent birth, so sure, our moral values about sex have changed, but the moral value underlying advice about sex is objective. Does that make sense? Could be objective. Because it still seems to me objectively good advice to not do things until you're ready for them. It doesn't mean you can't have sex, it just means you shouldn't have kids until you're ready. Questions about this? There's a lot of this. We could spend whole classes on each one of these, but if there's something that's kind of in your mind already and urgent to ask about it, take us into this. We can take a couple of minutes, but we need to move forward too. Skip the thing about Marxism. So the crucial thing is that you're a real relativist if you think that calling something wrong means that you disapprove of it. And here's where we get into the, I think this is our last study question. I want to make sure that I'm tracking these. Yeah. What are some of the essential features of ethical conversations that suggest the kind of objectivity that ethical values have for Singer? Well, here's his answer to that question, really. Real relativism is saying that something's wrong means I disapprove. Kind of like saying, you know, it's right because the gods believe it, right? And the problem with that, okay, take these into your notes in your own words, is that if that were true, we could just take polls to find out what's right or wrong. We just do a poll, a survey, right? If moral values were just a matter of what people approve or disapprove, then ethics would just be a matter, finding out what's right would just be a matter of taking a poll. But it clearly isn't. We have these conversations, we have these moral conversations, and they have rules to them, right? And you're having an ethical conversation. The fact that we can have meaningful, rational disagreements about ethics suggests that it's more than just saying, I like chocolate, right? I disapprove, I approve is kind of like saying, I like chocolate, I like strawberry. There's more to ethics because the conversations, this is the point for your notes, there's more to ethics than just approval and disapproval because ethical conversations have a rational structure to them. You give reasons. You appeal to the human good. There are ways of justifying your moral values. They may not be conclusive. That's another thing that draws people into relativism naively. The fact that we don't all agree at any one moment about it doesn't mean there isn't something objective that we're trying to discover. So for him, you know, the problem with being a subjective is fundamentally that you can't make sense of ethical conversation if you're a real relativist. Because ethical conversation really is about something. And you know, we might as well say it, like, right now, it's ultimately kind of about it's a conversation about the human good. Does that make sense? And where human means both individual and group, because we are both, we are a social species, right? We are a political species, Aristotle said it, right? Yeah, good.
So is that assuming that ethics, or at least our cultural ethics, are a social construct that has been given to us, or it's an underlying thing that we're simply born with, or both?
Good, no, good. That's a very good question. I would say the question of the human good is at play in human social processes. It's what humans spend a lot of their time thinking about. So I don't know if that really maps onto the alternative you gave me. You want to take another shot at it?
Well, I guess, like, I don't know, if part of our underlying DNA revolves around a social being, then I guess both are true.
You're going into absolutely the right direction. Let me see if I can just kind of give you a little more intuition. I don't want to say that we have DNA that makes us ethical. Nobody says that I know. Our genetic structure gives us a psychology which includes some interesting emotions like sympathy and empathy. And disposes us towards care. You don't have to teach a child to be solicitous of someone who experiences pain. Children really have kind of a psychology there. So it may be that biology comes into the picture somewhat indirectly. We're not biologically programmed to be ethical. We're biologically programmed to seek our genetic success. And we're in a social species, so many of our strategies for success in genetic terms, in evolutionary terms, are social strategies. And lo and behold, it turns out that our species has selected heavily for people who are good cooperators. Just like you in your life, in your social life, keep an eye out for that, right? Can I trust this person? Defect, cooperate is a huge dichotomy in ethics. Defect, cooperate is trust. Defect is, you know, screw the other person. Go your own way. Satisfy your interests. So we're not programmed. We don't have like a defect cooperate mechanism programmed into our genes, but we do have a lot of other capacities that unfold as we develop. An ability to know about other people's, what's going on in another person's head. An ability to care about other people's pain. And those things unfold in a child's development. They get nurtured or not, but they definitely unfold pretty naturally in a child's development. So there may be, put it in your notes this way, and we'll end on this, there may be moral emotions, which are not so much ethical emotions, but they're emotions which enable us to live on moral values, right? And some of those I've thrown around are things like sympathy and empathy. And those are in our biology, right? Good. Okay, guys, that was a good bit of work. We didn't get to everything, but we got to most things. We will have a quiz on Wednesday, so get ready for that. I hope the practice quiz was helpful, and I'll see you then.